memory. So last time we talked about how one can introduce chirality in deep brain models. There are roughly speaking three different ways that I introduced. One is intersecting brains, one is magnetized deep brains, and the third way that I introduced was deep brains and singularities. And I argued to you yesterday that these three different methods are in fact related by duality, more precisely mirror symmetry. So if you wish, you can just pick any one of these three methods and learn it very well, and you can get three things for the price of one. And so we start off with intersecting brains, because that's the easiest way to present this class of models. And what we talked about last time was the following. So the basic configuration of intersecting brain models involve at least two stacks of B-brains. They are intersecting over the four-dimensional space that we live, M4, and they intersect at a point in the internal space. And that's the reason why we're looking at B6 brains, because that's the only type of brains that would intersect at a point. And so this allows us to define a specific orientation, and hence chirality. Okay. And so the general result is, well, in principle, the intersecting brain setup that I introduced can be embedded in very complicated setup, via or orbitals or reticles. But locally, if you're only interested in locally near the place where the chiral fermions are located, the configuration just looks like this. And so the setup is completely specified by the relative angles between the deep brains, and I call it theta 1, theta 2, and theta 3. And you find that there are chiral fermions, a single chiral fermion located here, transforming in the bidimensional representation. And in order for this C-brain configuration to preserve supersymmetry, in order for you not to see any tachyonic scalar mode, for instance, you find that the angle has to be somewhere close to 0, more 2 pi. For the case where you have flat space, D-brains in flat space. But more generally, if you're looking at Calabial oriental code, the conditions that you will find is that these three-dimensional cycles that the D-brains wrap around are called special Lagrangian cycles. They are called special Lagrangian because A, they are Lagrangian, the restriction of the Kähler form on the three cycles is zero, and they are special because the imaginary part of that three form up to a phase is actually zero. So in order for the deep brain configuration to preserve a common supersymmetry, you need to find all the deep brains being calibrated with respect to the same three form, namely the phase over here is the same for all deep brains. In particular, you cannot have brain and anti-brain, because brain and anti-brain differ by phase, by pi, so they preserve a different set of supersymmetry. Now, if you don't remember exactly what this thing is all about, it's not going to be very important for today, because we will be mainly focusing on horizontal or orbital version of the models. So this is the condition that you need to keep in mind in order for the deep brain configuration to preserve the common supersymmetry. So Facebook. So if you type in my name in Facebook, you will find something that I am too embarrassed to tell you about. okay, so now this is the configuration that gives us four-dimensional chiral fermions, but that's not exactly what we are asking for. We don't exactly get a four-dimensional chiral theory with realistic gauge coupling. It's true that we get chiral fermions that are localized at the intersections. So the chiral fermions really lives in four dimensions. But the gauge field does not live in four dimensions. The gauge field propagates the entire world on the D6 brains. So before compactifying the theory, you have chiral fermions in four dimensions, but you have gauge fields in 6 plus 1 dimension, 7 dimensional space, the entire world all over the D6 brains. And furthermore, if you look at the gravitational fields, like gravitons and all the bulk approaching degrees of freedom, they live in the entire 10 dimensional space. So we do need to compactify this setup in order to get gauge sectors that couple to gravity with a finite value of PM mills and Newton constant. So that's what we are coming to discuss in more detail today, namely how to put the intersector brain setup into a compact setting. So that's the topic, first topic, compact four-dimensional models. Okay. So we will be considering type 2A, because we are looking at P6 brain, on four-dimensional space times X6, where this X6 is compact. So if you want to draw a picture, so this thing here is a four-dimensional space, and it's a product of four-dimensional space times a compact space, which I call X6. The D6 brains that we introduced are space filling in four dimensions. So if you want to draw a picture, they are filling up the four-dimensional space. But they also wrap around three-dimensional cycles. So schematically, you can denote the three-dimensional cycle by pi A. Now, the nice thing about putting things in a compact setup is now X6 as a finite volume and pi A as well as a finite volume. So when you compute the gauge coupling and the gravitational coupling, you get the non-vanishing result. But you also get a bonus because in addition to making sure that the gauge couplings are fine, the gauge couplings are finite, if you have two set of D-brains, actually I can use a different color, they could, in principle, intersect several times in the internal space. So they are, both of them are space filling, but as far as the internal six dimension is concerned, they don't have to intersect at only one single point. They could intersect at multiple points. And so from our discussion last time, at the intersection, we have chiral fermions in the bifundamental representation. And the fact that the two set of D-brains, pi A and pi B, intersect multiple times means that you have a replication of chiral families. Namely, you get chiral fermions transforming in the same representations, but with a multiplication factor, depending on how many times this two set of brains intersect in the internal space. So this is a setup that we are going to consider. And as you know, the standard model has three families of chiral fermions. So that's one of the things that we are trying to get today, namely to get a model with a multiplicity of three by looking at different type of D-brain configurations. So as a warm-up, we will first consider toroidal models because they are particularly simple. But please keep in mind that whatever I'm going to say for most part of the lectures, the general results and the techniques can and in fact have been adopted to more general configurations, including orbifolds as well as more general Calabi-Yau constructions some rational conformal field theory constructions known as Gaplan models. So, but we start with torus because they are easy to deal with. Are there any questions? So, section 3.1, toroidal models. Okay, so to start, we would begin with the simplest configurations. So, the simplest one we imagine is a six dimensional torus. And we are going to consider a six dimensional torus that can be written as a direct product of several two-dimensional torus to make things even simpler, so I can draw pictures. This is not generally the case, but let's look at this particular case. And so we would be considering basic frames spanning M4 and wrapping around a three-dimensional cycle. And we'll make a further simplification that this three-dimensional cycle that the D6 frame wrap around is a product of one cycle in each of the T2. So again, this is a simplification, but that allows me to actually draw a picture to show you how the D6 frames look like. So let's look at one example. So this is the first T2. This is the second T2. They don't have to be as square or bricks. By changing the complex structure of the torus, you can have a different shape. So I just draw that to make sure that we're covering a general case. So let's consider a six-dimensional torus like this, T2 cross T2 cross T2. And the type of D6 frames that I will be considering are wrapping one cycle in each of the T2. So an example will be the following. So let's define some location here. I can specify the three cycles that the D6 frames wrap around in terms of several integers. So in particular, the three-dimensional cycles that I was representing over there can be represented by six integers. So let's focus on the first torus. So this index I runs from 1 to 3, basically the first, second, and the third T2. Let's focus on the first one. So the first one, the first two torus, the one cycle is given by this. What that means is these two integers over here denote the number of times that the brains wrap around the basic homology cycles of the torus. So the A cycle is the one that I denote here. So this is A cycle. This is the A cycle. Okay. So according to this notation, this one cycle that I draw over there is represented by N and N equals to 1. Number one, because it wraps around the A cycle once, the B cycle once. Now, let's look at the second torus. If I call this the A cycle, and this the B cycle, just to make sure that you understand my notation, what is N and M for this one cycle? 1 minus 1. Because it wraps around, actually, 1 minus 1, because it wraps around the A cycle once, but it wraps around the B cycle in the reverse direction. So if you want to write out the entire free cycle, I can replace the information by a set of six integers. It will be 1, comma 1, 1, comma minus 1, and then the third one will be 1, comma 3. it wraps around A cycle once, but the B cycle three times.
How do you say which generation is happening?
So I always define my A cycle to be a horizontal one. So this is my A cycle. This is my B cycle. So if I draw something like this, it will be a 1, 1 because it wraps around the A cycle once and the B cycle positively. But since this wraps around the reverse direction, so I put a -1 just to remind me that this is the cycle that I wrap around. So is that clear?
On the second supposed to be, for example, a -1 + 1 or?
Oh, I'm sorry. I should actually put an arrow here because there's an orientation of the cycle too. So that's actually a very good point. What I should be drawing, in addition to the line, I also have to kind of use the orientation of the cycle. So put additional arrows in your picture. So that will become clear. So now everybody see this is 1 - 1. Okay. Good. Now, even though most of our discussions will be focusing on D-brains wrapping around this type of three cycles, but keep in mind that this is not the most general three cycles that D-brains can wrap around while preserving supersymmetry. Remember last time when we talked about D-brain recombination? Remember last time we discussed about D-brain recombination? So you can take two sets of D-brains, and sometimes you can find flat directions. Namely, you can find scalar fields, localized at intersections, scalar masses. By turning on this web, you get a new set of D-brains that look different from the original set of D-brains that you start with. So as an exercise, you can try to convince yourself, take two D6 brains, wrap around two of these factorizable cycles, things that can be written in this nice way, and give a back to them, to the scalar localizer at the intersection, and show that the resulting three-dimensional cycle is not necessarily factorizable. It's a very simple exercise. So just take two of these guys, add them together, and show that the corresponding three cycles that these brains wrap around is cannot be written in this factorizable form. So even though this is not the most general three-dimensional cycles that we can consider, but we will consider it anyway because that simplifies a lot of our discussions. But keep in mind that this is not the most general case. So is that clear what the setup is about? Okay. Now, as I said, the new thing that we introduced by compactifying the theory is that now you could have D-brains that intersect several times. And how do we figure out what's the multiplicity coming from the intersection? Well, so to figure out how many chiral fermions with the same representations do we get, we can define a topological number, which I would call it the intersection number. So the topological number is precisely what that means. Just count the number of times that the two D-brains intersect. And I should draw the picture here again. Now I introduce two different set of brains. The first set of brains wrap around this cycle. This is the first set of brains, which I call pi A. This is pi A. And I can have a second set of brains wrap around a different recycle. So this I call pi B. So Now we can just count. So if they intersect once on the first torus, 1, 2, 3, the second torus, 1, 2, 3, 4, with the third torus. So this topological quantity that I compute over here should give me 1 × 3 × 4, which is 12. So it turns out for something like a torus or orbit close, you can write down a closed form expression for this topological intersection numbers, and you can convince yourself the following expression is right. It's just given by the product of 1 to 3, and IA, MIP minus MAI, NDI. So it depends only on the set of integers that we define. It doesn't depend on the size or the shape of the torus. So this expression is explicit that it doesn't depend on the size and shape of the torus. It doesn't depend on the moduli. You can also see from the picture explicitly, imagine that you rescale the torus, make it bigger, or you make the torus taller or fatter. It doesn't change the number of intersection numbers. So at least should be, because it's a topological quantity. So you can show this formula by just using the basic fact that if you take the A cycle intersect with B cycle, it gives you 1. And if you take any of this A cycle with one another, the intersection is 0, and so on and so forth. Okay, so just use the intersection of the basic homology cycle. Now, we will be doing mostly calculation within using torus or orbital, so this formula will be applicable. But imagine that you are trying to construct a B-brain model in a Calabi-Yau space, then you would have to ask what are the intersection numbers between the special Lagrangian cycle. That, in general, could be a much more complicated problem to solve, because the type of special Lagrangian cycle in Calabi-Yau and the intersections are less understood than simple torus cases. But it could. If somebody hands you this set of topological number, you can immediately work out what is the chiral spectrum by just computing, by just noting that there will be chiral spectrum transforming in the bidimensional representation with this multiplicity. So the chiral spectrum is exactly the same as what we did last time, namely by fundamental fields, except you just have to multiply the answer by IAD. So sometimes you may get negative values when you compute the intersection. And that negative value is just a matter of convention. But suppose you pick the convention that positive intersection numbers give you left-handed chiral fermions in the bifundamental representation and comma n bar. Then a negative intersection number tells you that you have chiral fermions with an opposite chirality. So that's what the negative number means. So the same story that we were discussing last time applies. Namely, in addition to chiral fermions, which are massless, there could be massive or tachyonic scalar fields localized at the intersection. And it all depends on the angle between the brains. But in a compact space, the angle between the brains is a derived quantity, because it depends on the moduli. So for instance, if you look at this D-brain, it wraps around this cycle. The angle of the D-brain depends on the radius R1 and R2. So by change, so this is not a topological quantity now. The angle theta, when you check supersymmetry conditions, the angle that determines whether you get additional like scalars will be dependent on, in this case, the compact structure moduli, the ratio of R2 and R1. So if you want to be more precise, tangent theta is equal to n R2 over n R1. So only for special choices of the compact structure moduli do you get D-brain configurations that preserve common supersymmetries. So this is what we have for torus for now, and we will later discuss the generalization of this setup to more general cases, including orbitals and cutoff here. So are there any questions? If not, then that would bring us to the next topic. The fact that compactification gives us multiplicity of chiral fragments is nice, but it also introduces new constraints. Namely, the fact that when you introduce brains in the setup, you have to be careful about the fact that these brains carry Ramon-Ramon charge. So just like in ENM, if you have a system with charge, you need to make sure that the total charge in a compact space is equal to zero. Otherwise, the flux line has nowhere to go. And that translates to the statement that the total Ramon-Ramon tempo must vanish. So the statement is, the brain carries charge under the Ramon-Ramon p-form, because we have seen in the first lecture that there's such a coupling along the BP brain, it couples to the Ramon-Ramon form. And in a compact space, the total charge must vanish. So that gives you some constraints. And we were just discussing a while ago that the D-brain working around some three-dimensional cycles. So the D-brain charge carried by the six brains is completely characterized by the homology cycle that the D6 brain wraps around. So the fact that the total Ramon-Ramon charge has to vanish translates to the statement that all the homology cycles wrapped by the brains, when you add them together, must be topologically trivial. So you have so many number of brains, they wrap around this homology cycle. When you add them all up, they have to sum to zero. Otherwise, there's some net from one charge. So equivalently, you can understand this constraint from the consistency conditions for the supergravity equation of motion. And remember, the D brain couples to a 3 plus 1 form. So a D6 brain is coupled to a 7 form. So if you read off the space-time action involving the 7 form potential, there are only a couple of pieces. The piece of the space-time action that includes C7 is the kinetic term. Plus the explicit source into the D-brains. So H here is E of C7. So if you just collect the terms in the action, that includes the 7 form potential, because that's the one that couples to the D6 brain. There are only two pieces. One comes from the kinetic term for this C7, and the other comes from the explicit source due to the D-brains. And so you can just integrate this by parts, and you find that this looks like C7, which EH2, the minus sign, plus the sum of this Ramon-Ramon charge carried by the D-brains. So to satisfy the equation of motion, you need to break out more specifically. So I can just write it as minus C7 wedge with DH2 plus 1 over A, C7 wedge with the delta function. because I want to write everything in terms of a full 10-dimensional integral. And so this explicit source coming from the D brains is integrated only over the D6 brain well volume. So if I want to rewrite it as an integral over 10 dimension, I have a delta function. And the delta function is localized at the three cycles that the D6 brain will wrap around. Yes.
And the delta function is also like a free form.
It's a free form.
It's a free form and the delta function, or?
So delta is a free form, and it's localized at the three cycles.
So essentially you have like a delta function distribution,
mm-hmm.
which is only non-zero on the brain, and you have a free form?
Yeah. So it's a free form, which is non-vanishing only on when you evaluate on the three-dimensional cycle of the six brains. So this three forms together with the seven would be precisely the right thing that the 10-dimensional integral. It's just a formal way to write things.
Yeah.
What
do
you
call it? H?
I don't know. It's H. You should call it H?
I don't know.
Oh, yeah, so that's quite F. You like F?
I like F.
Okay, so if you like F better, switch your notation from H to F, whatever. Yeah, that's a good point, because later on we'll introduce one more one. Yes?
I have a question about this handful. I mean, this is like the integrated, it's like Gauss law that the charges are canceling, but
yeah.
If you would vary with respect to C7, you would get BH2,
yeah.
Which is like a free form everywhere.
Yeah.
And that has to be equal to this localized distribution delta function.
Yeah.
So how do you satisfy that?
This is a weaker constraint because
right.
It's an integrated form. So in principle, you should actually solve for the profile of H2 and H1 once I give you the six brains.
Right, but that would like require fluxes that are localized, or exactly on top of the brains.
No, so as we were talking about yesterday, it all depends on, so there could be a localized source, but the profile could spread out. So I haven't actually solved for this H2 here, but you can see that there's a consistency constraint. But you're right, so if you wanted to be more precise, you should solve this equation function.
Right.
So I think that's what you would expect when you have a supergravity solution. But if you have a supergravity solution, you see explicitly that there's a non-trivial profile for the H2.
Yeah, it does not give me, if I have on the right side a delta function that only is non-zero,
mm-hmm.
on top of the whole thing. Why can I have on the left side BH2, which is non-vanishing everywhere?
So what about this ENM analogy? So there could be a point source at the...
Right, I'm just saying this equation. If the right side is delta function,
mm-hmm.
how is the equation of motion satisfied?
So the equation of motion is TH2.
Right.
It is equal to C7.
Right.
Delta function.
No C7.
No, sorry. And A, delta function.
Right, so the right side is zero everywhere except on the whole thing.
Yeah, so there are localized sources for H. So it doesn't mean H2 has to be local.
Okay.
So just like in the traumatic systems, you can have point source, but the few lines does not have to be vanishing outside the location of the charge. So you can see that this is the equation of motion for the two. For the two-form field strength. And when you integrate this equation, so this equation has to be satisfied, has to be satisfied. And so if you can just integrate this equation, and what you get is this condition on the homology. Yeah.
So you ask one more question.
Yeah.
Because the DH2 is in fact some modifications like an H2 A and not times F2. So there is just the flux contribution.
Yeah.
And this flux contribution cancels the charge, right? And
so this simply says that the D6 brain give you a source for H2. Actually,
yeah.
I mean, if you wish, you can just write it as B of H2.
Yeah.
So this just tells you that the D brains provide source for this A form future.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is what we expected, because D brains are source for this C7, C7's kinetic times F, H8, or F8 if you want. Yeah?
So,
So that means it's topologically trivial. Yeah. So you can, of course, expand these three cycles in a particular basis. Then what that means is, in the basis of three cycles, each of these coefficients has to be zero. So actually, we will soon take a look at some examples where we will expand this three cycle into a canonical basis. And so in that case, you just match the coefficient of each of these basis three cycles to be zero. Yeah. Okay. So that explains why there's the Ramon-Ramon capital constraints when you try to build a B-brain models in a local in a compact setup. But how do we understand this Ramon-Ramon capital conditions from a four-dimensional point of view? So how do we understand this? So we are going to show now that this Ramon-Ramon capital conditions are important because if they are violated, you will find that there will be chiral anomalies in the four-dimensional effective field. So that's why there's an alternative way to see why this condition needs to be satisfied. From the string theory point of view, it's the cancellation of the Ramon-Ramon charge. From a four-dimensional effective field theory point of view, this is a statement that there should be no chiral anomalies in the four-dimensional field theory. Now, there are many different kinds of four-dimensional chiral anomalies. There are anomalies that are purely non-abelian. There are anomalies that are mixed gravitational with the U1 view, for instance. There are anomalies that are mixed U1 with non-abelian. So each of these anomalies have to be cancelled. Okay. Okay, so the first type of anomaly that would come to your mind is cubic non-abelian anomalies. So in four dimensions, the anomalies are triangle anomalies. So you can write down a triangle Feynman diagram, and you can insert non-abelian gauge views at the three vertex of a triangle. So SUN, the same SUN of three of them. So the statement about anomaly cancellation is, in four dimensions, you should not see any anomalies of this type. So the triangle anomalies should cancel. So this type of anomaly should not be there. So if you remember in field theory, this SU3 cube anomalies just compute the number of fundamental minus the number of anti-fundamental representation of SU3. Because there could be, in principle, something more complicated, but since we are dealing with models where the spectrum only contains fundamental representation or anti-fundamental representation, that statement about SU3 cube anomaly is just a statement that the number of fundamental representation should be equal to the number of anti-fundamental representation. But that's very simple to compute. If I tell you the spectrum, you can immediately tell me whether there's anomalies. So as we said, the spectrum that we get is a multiplicity of fields that transform in this representation. So if you just fix one of this guy, so let's say I am interested in calculating the anomalies of the first gauge method, all I have to do is to sum over all the contribution, all the brains in the model that has non-zero intersections with the brains that give me SU and a gauge group. So that's the intersection number times the multiplicity, because as far as the first SUN gauge factor is concerned, this just gives me a multiplicity factor. So this literally counts the cubic anomalies of the model. So sum over all brains, let's say fix the set of brains that give me SUNA, and scan through the entire set of B brains that has non-zero intersections, and that counts the number of fundamental representation as well as anti-fundamental representation, because the sign of this IAB actually takes into account the N or N bar representation. So all we have to do is to show that as long as the Ramon-Ramon type cancels, this guy is identically vanishing. So, can anybody see immediately why that's true? So this is the Ramon-Ramon half-full condition. And the claim is, as long as the tadpole cancels, you don't find cubic anomalies. So this equation is implied by the first one. Any take it? It's a one line proof. Exactly. So this equation is true this equation is an identity. So you just pick the intersection of this equation with pi b, arbitrary pi b. Then you would get sum over Na, I A B is equal to 0, which is exactly what we're trying to prove. So the statement is, as long as the Ramon-Ramon tadpole is cancelled, you don't expect to see chiral anomalies in the effect before the natural gauge series, which is nice.
Why does this vector seem to be going away?
So IAB gives me the multiplicity, and B also gives me the multiplicity. And this counts number of fundamental representation. So by summing over all, I take into account all possible fields in the spectrum that transform as a fundamental representation of the SU and A gauge group. And since I was already careful about fundamental versus anti-fundamental representation with the sign of IAB, this counts the number of fundamental minus the number of anti-fundamental. Now, but that's an interesting fact you actually could observe here. Namely, this equation is true even if Na is equal to 1 or 2. So I could have D-brains, a stack of D-brains that contain 1 or 2 D-brains stacked together. It doesn't have to be bigger than 2. But we know that there's no cubic anomalies for SU2 gauge group, or if you wish, SU1 gauge group. So the Ramon-Ramon type of condition is actually slightly stronger than anomaly cancellation. So this fact turns out to be important later on when we try to construct phenomenological model. In particular, the fact that the SU2 gauge group of the Zander model, if you try to embed it into D-brain setup, there's a condition that needs to be satisfied, even though from a 4D effective theory point of view, you don't necessarily have to impose some constraints, because SU2 gauge theory does not give you cubic anomalies. So, but that's not all the anomalies that we have. You also have mixed anomalies that involve U1 gauge fields as well. So, in particular, you can consider the following triangle diagrams. You could have a U1 field through this triangle coupled to two SUN gauge fields. So that's a mixed U1 anomaly. Mixed U1. Let's call this B. A times SU2 B square anomaly. So again, if you don't remember what this anomaly is proportional to, you can go back and look at the field theory textbook. And basically, this anomaly counts the U1 charge times some trace of the representation under the SUN group. And you can show that the anomaly coming from this triangle diagram is proportional to Na times IAB. So I leave it as an exercise. It's very simple again. Once you remind yourself what it is, this is the anomaly, the mixed anomaly is proportional to this quantity over here. and without the sum. So even if we impose the temporal condition, this is not necessarily equal to zero. So does that mean that we are screwed? So does that mean the Raman-Raman temporal condition does not imply cancellation of anomalies in four-dimensional theories? That is no, because in string theory, in addition to the triangle diagrams, there's also the Green-Schwarz diagram. That's at the heart of the anomaly cancellation in 10 dimensions. But in 4 dimensions, you can also write down an equivalent or similar Green-Schwarz diagram. So the diagram that actually cancels the field theory anomalies here is the Green-Schwarz term, which mixes the U1 gauge field. So this is the U1 gauge field. It's coupled to the true form. And that true form, in turn, coupled to two SUN gauge groups. So without this diagram, then the theory is inconsistent in four dimensions. But because in string theory, we also have some additional field, then we have two-form anti-symmetric field. And the fact that the U1 gauge field couples to this two-form field give you an additional diagram that could cancel this anomaly. So where does this diagram come from? So remember, we are looking at D6 frames. So on the world form of the D6 frames, you have couplings of the form. The reason why we went at great length in the first lecture to discuss the Western minimum term is because they give us all these kind of couplings. So the D6 frames wrap around a free cycle. So when you reduce this term on the world model of the D6 frames, you get a two-form view coming from integrating this five form over the cycles in which the D frames wrap. And similarly, when you reduce this trans-diamond term on the world wall of the D6 frames, you will also get a pseudo-scalar, which is dual to the B field over there. So the Green-Schwarz term really comes from this trans-diamond coupling. When you work out everything in great detail, you'll find that the diagram coming from the exchange of B field exactly cancels the triangle anomalies. So again, I leave it as an exercise for you to work out why that's the case. But you see the structure, how it comes about, because this coupling gives you precisely the two form as we normally use to consider an anomaly in string theory. Finally, there's another anomaly, which is the mixed U1 gravitational anomaly. So I leave it again as an exercise for you to show that in this class of models, in toroidal models, the mixed U1 gravitational anomalies automatically cancel without even having to include the Green-Schwarz term. So to summarize, once you cancel the Raman-Raman tackle, as far as the gauge theory on the D6 frames is concerned, it's anomaly free. Are there any questions? No? Okay, good. But this Green-Schwarz term also gives us also tells us something interesting about the U1 fields in the theory. So you see, the fact that the U1 field couples to the B field means that there could be a mass term induced by this U1. In particular, I could just draw a diagram like this. So you have this U1 gauge field. It couples to the two form, which in fact is coupled to the U1 gauge rate itself. And what does that give us? It gives us a mass term for this U1 here. So this gives you a mass term for the gauge here. Okay. So what that means is, as long as you have, you find some two-form field that's coupled to the U1 field with some non-coupling, which I call the BF coupling. Well, obvious reason, because this gives you the coupling of the B field with the gauge field. The BF coupling gives masses to the U1 field. So even though you may seem to have find a model with a bunch of U1s in the low energy, not all of them actually survive. Some of them could be anomalous. And sometimes, even if they are not anomalous, there could still be a non-zero coupling between the gauge field with the two-form field to give it a mass. So one has to be careful then, because when one tries to construct a standard model, you need to make sure that the U1 hypercharge of the standard model is not one of these U1 gauge field that gets massive because of the green shots mechanism. So are there any questions so far? Okay, so I think this is a good place to just briefly mention some phenomenological features of this type of deep brain models without actually going into detail of specific models, because we can already extract a lot of interesting lessons about this toroidal example, which in fact are general for intersecting brain models in general. So I can at least think about a couple of them. So one of them is proton stability. So it turns out this class of models, as far as the proton is concerned, is perturbatively stable. And the reason is that the SU3 gauge group really comes from a U3 group. There's always an overall U1 factor, the center of mass of the D-brains. And that U1, which sits within the U3, is the barrier number. So this U1 barrier number, even though it will not survive as a gauge symmetries at low energy, just like some of this U1 that I was mentioning earlier, it would get a mass, but it could survive as a global symmetry at low energy. It's broken by non-perturbative effects like in. So this U1 variant number protects this deep brain model from having unstable proton. And in fact, some recent work actually was trying to address this question by actually computing explicitly this instanton effect to see how the standard model variant number is broken in some explicit intersecting deep brain models. The second point is about gauge unification. And perhaps this is one of the objections on things that a lot of people have towards intersecting brain models. Namely, it's not in general you find gauge couplings being unified at train scale, because as we mentioned, the gauge coupling is inversely proportional to the volume of the cycle in which the brains wrap around. And there's no reason why the gauge group that the SU3, SU2, and U1 gauge group correspond to brain wrap around the cycles with the same volume. So this is an additional constraint that you need to impose in order to see gauge unification at the train scale. However, you can turn this around and say, well, the experimental value of the gauge coupling of SU3, SU2, and U1 impose some constraints on the volume of the cycles in which the brains could wrap around. And in the lecture tomorrow, we'll probably see some examples in which you can actually compute the wide-grade angle for some deep brain models. So electroweak symmetry breaking. And a lot of these models can be represented rather geometrically as deep brain recombinations. as we mentioned earlier, there are light scalar fields that are localized at the intersections. When you give back to this light scalar field, the deep brain would recombine to some recombined brain. And in particular, the Higgs field in some explicit deep brain models comes from the intersection of an SU2 brain with some U1 brain. So giving a VAP to the Higgs field corresponds to combining the electrically weak brain with the hypercharged brain to get a final deep brain, which gives us U1 EMM. So as far as electrically weak symmetry brain is concerned, you can think of it as deep brain recombination. Finally, you also expect to see a hierarchy in the Yokawa couplet. In this class of intersecting brain models. And again, it's very easy to see it because the Higgs field is a scalar field localized at the intersection of the SU2 and U1 brain. So this is where the Higgs field is. And now if you ask what is the Yokawa coupling for the quarks, then you have to first ask where the quarks come from. The quarks are charged under the SU3 and SU2. So if this is the brain circuit in SU3, then this could be the quarks. This transform has three commutators. A quark. And this is our quark. Because it is charged under SU3 and U1 except SU3 and SU2. And the way we get different chiral families come from intersections. So different families are located at different intersection points, even though they have the same quantum numbers. So if you wish, this is the third generation, this is the second generation, and the first generation, and so on. And again, I can label this U3, U2, U1. So these are all SU3 brains. So the fact that you have Q1, Q2, Q3 is the origin of the three families. Now, the Yokawa coupling is exponentially suppressed by the area of the worksheet that stretch between the Higgs field and the magnetic field. So when you compute the three-point coupling between the quark and the Higgs field, because they are localized at different places, the wave functions have exponential tail. And so you expect your power coupling to go like exponential of the area in string units. So this gives us a hierarchy of your powers for different generations. So in particular, the first generation is more suppressed because the area of the worksheet is stretched between the Higgs field and the quark is much bigger. So you get a much lighter family for the first generation and the third generation. So this is so far a schematic picture. One still has to find a model that gives you the spectrum of the standard model. But if you do find one, then you expect to see that you can at least manufacture hierarchy the couplings from the geometry.
Sorry.
Yeah.
But in this way, you get the same Yokawa coupling for the up and down in the same generation.
Yeah. So the signal degeneracy within the family.
Isn't this replacing the fine tuning of the coupling, just by fine tuning of the geometry?
Yeah, so in fact, so the same could be said about Randall Sandra. So you have a hierarchy of the electric weak scale compared with the plus scale. You solve the hierarchy problem by introducing a walk factor. So you replace the problem by yet a different problem. And you can even say that this is exponentially sensitive to the number that you generate. So if I move this brain slightly a little bit, I get an exponentially sensitive answer compared with the original configuration. The same thing could be said about a warp model like Brandon Sandberg. If you move the brain slightly away from the TUV brain location, then you get a different hierarchy, exponentially sensitive hierarchy. That's the That's the virtue of an exponent. Okay, so any questions so far? Now, turns out all the ingredients that I have introduced so far did not get us to the standard model. There's yet another ingredient that we need to introduce in order to get there, and that is orientables. So how many of you know what is an orientable? Okay, good, but not everybody. So don't feel offended if I say something that you already know. So an orientable, the word orientable is a play of the word orbital, with some essential difference. So unlike an orbital, which acts only on the target space, and orientable also acts on the world sheet as well. So the simple way to picture an orientable is to just draw an imaginary plane. So in fact, we will be dealing a lot with the orientable six planes. So an orientable projection flips the orientation of a string, as well as reflecting the spatial force. So an orientable plane is the set of points in which they are invariant under the orientable projection. So an orientable reverse the world sheet orientation, and together with the spatial reflection. So I join here an orientable six planes, but there could be some other orientable planes as well. So why do we introduce orientables? If we don't have to, we should not introduce anything that we don't need. So as we have discussed before, in a compact space, the total Ramon-Ramon charge must vanish. So you can, of course, cancel the Ramon-Ramon charge with something that carries a negative charge, like anti-brains. But if we are interested in supersymmetric models, where we want to preserve supersymmetry, not only do we need to make sure that the total Ramon-Ramon charge cancel, we also need to cancel the tension of the e-brains as well. And so we need objects that carry negative charge and negative tension. And the orientable planes that I introduced over here is precisely an object that has this property. Namely, it carries the opposite charge and opposite tension versus a d-brain. Turns out there's another reason why we introduced the orientable plane, and that will come later. And we are going to show a little noble theorem that suppose you have no orientable planes in your model, your d-brain models would necessarily contain some SU2 chiral exotics. Namely, there will be some additional chiral fields with SU2 quantum numbers that you don't want. So from a phenomenological point of view, that's also why this orientable plane will be introduced. So to see why that's the case, let's remind ourselves some properties of an orientable plane. And to start, again, we'll consider the simplest case, namely 10-dimensional flat space, and introduce orientable planes in the setup. So let's consider Q2A in 10-dimensional flat space. We introduce the orientable planes by modding out the type 2 theory by a discrete C2 symmetry. And this discrete C2 symmetry does two things. First, it acts on the world sheet degrees of freedom. It flips the orientation of the world sheet. So omega is defined such that sigma and tau of the world sheet coordinates is mapped to minus sigma and tau. So the orientation of the worksheet is reverse by omega. It's a C2 symmetry because if you do it twice, you just don't do anything. And the reflection, I'm going to choose a very simple C2 action, which acts on x5, x7, and x9 with a minus sign. And why do I pick 5, 7, and 9? It's just my convention. If you want to be more precise, actually, the oriented flow that we should be modeling out by has an extra factor of minus 1 to the power FL, where FL is a worksheet Fabian number. And then if it is for technical reason, then you can argue why that has to be the case. You can argue it from C duality. But for the moment, since we are not going to worry too much about that, you can suppress this factor. But if you want to go deep into the details, as a homework exercise, try to convince yourself that there is an extra factor minus 1 to the F that acts on the worksheet variable. So if we model the type 2A theory by this orientable projection, the subspace in which the subspace which is invariant under this action is called an orientable six planes. And the orientable six planes fixed points of this orientable projection being the O6 plane. The O6 plane is defined by x5 equals to x7 equals to x9 equal to 0, but span the remaining coordinate. So the remaining 6 plus 1 dimensions. So we can represent it by a imaginary plane over here. So just draw a plane. And you will see why I said it's imaginary, because there are no dynamical degrees of freedom that are localized to the orientable plane. Now, the interesting thing about the orientable plane, as I said, is they carry tension and charge, exactly opposite from a D-frame. And so you can calculate the tension and the charge of an orientable plane by computing two different open string diagrams. So this is a D-frame. And you can compare the answer of this open string one loop diagram with or without the orientable plane. By comparing these two diagrams, you would come to the conclusion that indeed the orientable plane carries charge tension. And I won't go through it here, but you would find it in, say, Kuczynski's textbook. So you would find that as far as orientable six planes are concerned, it carries negative Ramon-Ramon charge. And if you normalize the charge of a D6 brain to be 1. So if you know D6 brain charge to be plus 1, you find from this calculation over here that an orientable 6 plane carry charge equal to minus 4. The charge depends somewhat on the dimensions. So if you have oriental three planes, for instance, the charge is minus a half. So, but you also get more oriental planes. Well, I am actually lying a little bit, because there are actually two types of oriental planes. There are certain types of oriental planes that carry positive D-brain charge. But for the sake of not confusing you, I'm not going to talk about this kind of oriental plane for the rest of the lecture, but they do exist. So is if you have, in a compact space, both keyframes and orientable plane, the Ramon-Ramon capital cancellation would now be modified. So instead of summing over the homology cycles of all the D-brains being zero trivially, you now have contributions of Ramon-Ramon charge from the old six planes, and so the conditions become sum over all the D-brains and A by A plus sum over A and A by A prime minus 4 by O6 equals 0. So I need to explain a little bit what this equation means. So the one with the prime over here are the three cycles grabbed by the image of the D6 plane. Remember, an oriental plane maps a set of points on one side of the oriental plane to the other. So if you have D-brains wrapped around a cycle, wrapped around a cycle pi A, the oriental plane maps this D-brain configuration to its image. And in general, this is not going to be the same as the original three cycles that the D6 brains wrap around, and they could carry D-brain charge as well, so they contribute to the tangle. And the minus 4 here is just the fact that the oriental plane carries 4 units of D-brain charge. So now, this would be Ramon-Ramon tangle cancellations. Now there's an additional subtlety, which I'm not going to convince you at the moment, because we'll see it tomorrow, is that in the presence of the oriental plane, actually just cancellating the Ramon-Ramon charge oftentimes is not enough. There could be some additional C2 value, K-theory charge, carried by the D-brains in the presence of the oriental plane. So on top of cancellating the Ramon-Ramon charge carried by the D-brains, you also need to make sure that the D-brains do not carry any net C2 charge as a whole in the compact space. This C2 charge, just like the Ramon-Ramon charge, must be canceled consistently. Otherwise, you'll find that there's some anomaly in the low energy. But I won't do it for now, and I'll save it when I have an explicit model to discuss. Okay, so for most practical purpose, the D6 brains and the O6 brains are very similar, except for the charge and the tension, the sign of the charge and the tension. But the most important thing is perhaps the fact that an oriental plane is not a dynamical object, in the sense that there are no open strings that are stuck on the world volume of the O6 brains. But that, again, is a bit of an oversimplification. That's the case when we are looking at weak coupling and constant dilaton. For instance, when you go to F-theory, the oriental planes, well, in that case, it's not O6 planes, but O7 planes. You can think of the oriental planes as a bound state of D-brains that are not mutually local. So in that case, the oriental planes are actually dynamical. But in the limit in which we are working on now, namely we are looking at perturbative open strings, you can treat the oriental plane as a fixed object with no dynamical degrees of freedom attached to it. So I spent quite a bit of time today talking mainly about toroidal cases and oriented flows and D-brains and so on and so forth. But keep in mind that when you look at more general examples, you can also define what an oriented flow is. It's just a little bit less straightforward than one that I introduced before. In general, you can define an oriented flow plane as the set of points that are fixed under the oriented flow projection. When sigma bar over here is a C2 involution on your compact space. So sigma bar is a isometric. Doesn't change the metric. Isometric anti-holomorphic involution. So if you're working in the Calabrian space, you could ask whether there exists such a C2 involution that maps the space by this C2 symmetry. And this C2 symmetry in general has to satisfy the constraint that it maps the Kähler form to minus the Kähler form and the free form to the conjugate of the free form. Again, that could be up to a base. So even though in this three lectures, we will be only looking at toroidal example and orbital examples, in general, in fact, many examples have been constructed, for instance, Gapner-oriented flows or Kalabata-oriented flows. In those cases, the first step that one would need to figure out is what are the C2 involution of the Calabi-Yau space that you have. And if you do find such a C2 involution, you can define such an oriented flow thing, and then you can ask what kind of D-brains can be introduced to the models. So I think in the remaining time, what I would do is to work out the spectrum, the open string spectrum, in the presence of both orientable planes and both D6 brains. So remember, in the case where we have only D brains, the spectrum is extremely simple, just by fundamental views and that's it. So how does the picture get multiplied when you have orientable planes? So open string spectrum with O6 and D6. So there are many ways that one can follow to work out the spectrum of open strings in this background of D-brains and oriented planes. But I think the easiest is perhaps just go to the covering space before you introduce oriented planes and work out the spectrum of open strings in the covering space. But afterwards, in post, the identification implied by the oriented projection. So basically, go to the covering space. Spectrum, and then identify the spectrum under the oriental symmetry. And so that would be the spectrum of open strings in an oriental model. So in fact, there are quite a few cases that you need to consider. Consider brains that are parallel to the oriental planes. And so that's the easy case. So that, again, you can divide the two cases. You could have an oriental six plane and a stack of D brains that are parallel to the O6 planes and lying on top of the O plane. And a bunch of D-brains that are stacked and lying on top of the old planes. So before we introduce the oriental plane in the covering space, the spectrum of D-brains give us just a UN gauge group. Right? No oriental plane. So the oriental plane reverses the endpoints of the strings, it reverses the orientation. So if you start out with an open strings with indices A and B lying on the endpoints of the string, the oriental projection map it to B A. This identification does nothing other than breaking the UN symmetry to an SO or SB symmetry, depending on other subtle sign over here. And that's usually the source of all evil. When you try to actually construct some models, you have to be very careful about this. It would affect whether you get a syntactic group or an orthogonal group at the end of the day. But the idea is very simple. So before that, you have n squared different ways of that the open strings can end. This identification kills half of this possibilities, and you end up having either an orthogonal group or a syntactic group. So But the D6 brains do not necessarily have to lie on top of the oriented four planes. So we could have again the O6 planes. So the D6 brains are parallel but away, staying away from the O plane. All the O plane does is to map a stack of D brains, D6 brains, to its image. So in the covering space, you have UN cross UN gauge group. The oriented projection does give you UN gauge group. So in the end of the day, you have only a single unitary group. And you can intuitively understand why that's the case, because you would expect at the master's level, this D6 brains would not know about the existence of some distant object. If you're only looking at massless or light excitations of the D6 brains, the fact that there's some oriented four planes far away from the D6 brains should not matter. So which means that this N D6 brains in torsion at the massless level only give us one single capital of unitary group. It doesn't know about the existence of the other guys sitting at the mirror image. There's one observation which is useful here, and that is, as we said, an oriented pole plane reverses the orientation. So an open space that starts from a set of D6 brains get mapped to an open space that end on the D6 brains in the image. So that means a fundamental representation get mapped to an anti-fundamental representation for the image set of D-brains. And that turned out to be important later on when we were on the full spectrum of open space. So that's the easy part for D6 brains that are parallel to the O planes. What about D6 brains that are not parallel to the O plane? Something like this. So we now consider D6 and O6 that are not parallel. There are quite a number of cases that you need to consider, and let me just list them all out at once and for all. And when we are done, we will have a very nice table summarizing the complete spectrum, so you don't have to come back to this picture over again about the chiral spectrum of the model. So first case, you have O6 plane, and you have a set of D-brains. Okay, this is A, B. So you have a set of D-brain, which are called A, intersect with another set of D-brain, which are called B. But there is also the set of brains that are mirrored to that under the oriented form, so which are called B' and B'. So in the covering space, I would have UN cross UM, two copies of them, because supposing that this set of brains give me UN group, this give me UM, I have UN cross UM, the two steps. But the same argument that I was giving earlier tells us that we only keep one linear combination. The oriented fold keep only one side of the, keep only one copies of this gauge and chiral sector. And so what you have is nothing but the number of intersection of these brains times n bar representation. Not two copies of that. And I know this is kind of boring, but let's just work it out through, and it will take about 2 more minutes. So there's another case where you have A intersect with the image of B, and so on. So again, the oriented fold gives only one copy of the whole thing, so it would give me IAB. Prime. But instead of NM representation is NF. Because, as we said, the image D6 brains in comparison to the original deep brains, flip the fundamental versus anti-fundamental representation. And similarly, you can consider two other cases. The D6 brain could intersect with its own oriental image. And that also gives you two possibilities. Either they intersect precisely on top of the O6 plane, or they intersect away from the O6 plane. So the open strings that localize at the intersection of the A with its image transform as symmetric and anti-symmetric representation. But the oriented foot projection only keeps one of them, so only the anti-symmetric representation survives for the first case over here. Whereas if you have deep brains intersecting with this image away from the oriented foot plane, you keep both the symmetric and anti-symmetric representation, but you only keep half, only keep this side of the compass. So just to summarize, if you have patience and you work it out all through, this is the complete chiral spectrum of an oriental model. So you can express everything in terms of this intersection number. This is the entire chiral spectrum of the deep brain model. So there are a certain number of symmetric and anti-symmetric representation by fundamental and so on. And even though I have worked out the spectrum for you in the case of the toroidal case, turns out the results also apply for more general backgrounds, including orbifolds and even calabial, as long as you interpret this homology cycle correctly. So in the case of the orbital, it is a homology cycle in the orbital space, not in the torus. But with the correct interpretation, this gives you the complete chiral spectrum of the model. And so let's see. Are there any questions? No. So in principle, you have all the tools to construct a standard model of deep brains. So you have your oriental model. This is the chiral spectrum. And I also wrote down for you the Kappel cancellation, the cancellation of the Raman-Raman charge. And if you really have to put in any homework, you could try and see if you can find the standard model with the current tools that we have. So next time, we will start off with the following. We will first prove a little no-go theorem that I mentioned earlier. Namely, without the oriental planes, you always find some unwanted chiral exotics under the SU2DH group. That's actually, again, a one-line proof. You can easily show that. And that proof also points us to precisely what we need to do in order to get rid of all these exotics. And so we would then do a local model of deep brains that are free of the exotics, and we try to incorporate it into a global construction where your Raman-Raman cycles are cancelled together with this additional subtlety with the C2 K3 charge. And we will discuss it for specific problems tomorrow. Okay? All right. So thank you for your time.